From the Sky News Centre at 6, a convicted IRA bomber has named four men he claims carried out the 1974 Birmingham pub blasts in which 21 people died. The witness, known only as O, told inquest he had been given permission to reveal the identities by the current head of the terror group. The issue of who carried out the attacks isn't within the scope of the hearings. But Michelle Seeley, whose dad Paul Davis died that day, is glad the details have come out.
It's a bonus, I suppose. Wasn't expecting it, but we knew anyway. It wasn't something new to us, so we already knew. To let everybody else know.
Police say the death of student Libby Squire is being treated as a potential homicide. The 21-year-old had been missing since the start of last month until her body was found in the Humber estuary on Wednesday. Theresa May's hopes of getting her Brexit deal approved by MPs at the third attempt have been dealt a blow. The DUP, who prop up her minority government, have suggested they'll vote against it. The party's deputy leader says the PM's failure to get further concessions from Brussels is inexcusable. Tory MP Ben Bradley backed Mrs. May's deal last time, but says he's not sure how he'll vote if it comes back to the Commons again.
It's amazing that we're in a position where we're asking Parliament what it wants to see from Brexit a week before the deadline, when we've been doing this for 2 years. If we were going to go and ask that question, now is not the time. We should have been doing this years ago.
Some breaking news. We're just hearing that two men have been arrested over attacks on five mosques in Birmingham. The buildings had their windows smashed on Wednesday night into Thursday morning. That's the latest. I'm Kit Bradshaw.
Only in BCFM.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's weekly politics show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news as Labour councillor for Froome Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones. Also, we're joined by Jewish Bristolian musician Mark Smullyan. Labour Party Oxford economist and Irish Republican Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, more shocking evidence that Boeing knew the 737 MAX was a death trap, but were more concerned about their reputation than passengers' lives. And it's not the first time either, fake parts being installed on Boeings, but no action being taken to stop them. Instead, the whistleblower was sacked. Plus, as more emerges about a mass killer who shall not be named over in Christchurch, what was going on at the same time as the mass shooting? And what countries have issued threats against New Zealand over the last few years and why? Plus, the latest David Kelly death book. What's emerged about the reasons for the killing of a government scientist at the height of the Iraq War, WMD lies, and how the killing was covered up. Speak to retired pathologist David Halpin. Plus, the Rothschild anti-Semitic trope. Well, what is a trope? And what are the facts behind the so-called wealth of the Rothschild family and their influence? Is it legitimate to single them out despite the fact that they're Jewish? Plus, from the Israeli Security Cabinet, Moshe Kalon, secretive finance minister. What does he have to say about the Israeli state's biblical history and rights? What about the Christian Zionists in America? What are they saying to encourage him? That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry this weekend, around 11 Celsius. That is mainly cloudy with some sunny spells on Sunday. This week, coming week, highs around 16, pretty warm, plenty of sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 30th and 31st of March, Highs of 14 Celsius, partly cloudy. I think we'll be in the EU next weekend still, won't we? That was the Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Labour councillor for Froom Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones. Nicola, can you just start by telling us something about the area you serve? It's around French area, which has been a lot of changes. The hospital, the hospital's gone now. And I think is it all houses covering it now?
Yes, yeah, it's quite a diverse area, really. You've got Franche Park, you've got the sort of area that joins with fish ponds. There's quite a different mix of housing, which is a really nice prospect, really, if anyone's interested in the area. It's got a great sense of community, and people are doing lots of things to make the area better. So it's a really amazing place.
Franche was one of had a reputation as one, even though it's very old hospital, is an extremely good one. How's the closure of that and the sell-off and the moving over to Southmead, how's that gone down?
Well, it's not gone down very well. You know, a lot of people were dependent on Franche Hospital for obviously their medical needs. There's a lot of, sort of elderly people who are limited in terms of their mobility, so having to find other places to go to the GP or to get to Southmead Hospital is a really big deal for them. So I think a lot of people feel that they were cheated when Franche closed and there wasn't an alternative for them to go to.
There's also this kind of almost epidemic going on within the health service, which is a pressure on them to sell off land. We've seen the General Hospital here in Bristol sold off for luxury flats. Yeah. Well, actually, it was supposed to be sold off for flats, which included some affordable housing. But the developers said, well, actually, we changed our mind. We're not going to build any affordable housing. And they waited and waited. Eventually, the council had to cave in. So that's the General Hospital. We've also got the big hospital opposite the BRI. I'm not quite sure what that is. It's in mothballs now. It seems as if there's quite a lot of selling off for the family silver going on in the health service at the moment.
I don't know. Yeah. I haven't encouraged that, so Martin? Don't blame me.
Well, I mean, we can see, it's not just the health service. I mean, the pressure on budgets of public bodies means that they've got to sweat whatever assets they've got, which is leading to situations where, you know, what should be public assets in perpetuity are being flogged off because they need to, you know, keep services on the road.
Well, the other thing that springs to mind is sometimes these new places like Southmead Hospital, it's all PFI, so it's not actually even owned by the trust or by the public. It's owned by various financial institutions.
Well, we've had 13 years of Labour government before the present lot came in, and nothing was done about PFI at all. It's just ridiculous. It's going to be an albatross round our necks for many decades to come. And of course a Labour government, which possibly Nicola may be part of if she wins her parliamentary election campaign, will have to untangle this Gordian knot.
So where are you standing, Nicola?
Kingswood.
And how does that process happen? How do you put yourself forward and say, I think I'd be good as an MP?
Well, the Labour Party have a selection process where members of the constituency invite people to apply. I was one of those people. And then they have a hustings and they make a decision about which candidate they want.
Okay, so also we've had over the last few weeks, and they've had on the BBC as well, that's on Points West, quite a lot looking at this Lloyd's Business Support Unit on Castle Park. If you've got any police friends, you might actually want to text them, give them a call and say, have a listen to this, because I did an interview, which we're just about to hear, with Anthony Stansfield, who's the Police and Crime Commissioner for Thames Valley Police, who has some fascinating things to say about what's going on in here in Bristol. I would imagine there are things that the Police and Crime Commissioner Sue Mount-Stevens couldn't or wouldn't want to say. The Chief Constable here, Avon and Somerset Police, Andy Marsh, couldn't or wouldn't want to say. And also those people who are on the Police and Crime Panel. I mean, it was because we had Afshar Shah from the Police and Crime Panel here last week that put us onto this, really. And he was being very careful about the words he used. Anthony Stansfield is not, really. He's very open about what he believes is alleged fraud going on here in the city. And because the Avon and Somerset Police are a soft touch, basically, that nationally Lloyd's are allegedly saying Anthony's saying allegedly is that Lloyd's have chosen Bristol as a place to put this unit because they think that Avon and Somerset Police won't investigate them here. And he's alleging, as you're just about to hear, anything up to $1 billion of fraud. Now, Martin, this is not the first time this sort of thing has happened. It's happened in other countries. Mm. It also happened with HBOS, with RBS, where what the banks do is they put pull in loans without any warning and then sell off to their mates, basically to their chums, and this was proven in Reading with the HBOS case, the assets of somebody at a knockdown price.
Well, I think when the crisis hit in 2008, all of the banks were insolvent. They still are, in fact, if you looked at it properly. And of course, they're desperate for cash, so they took in money. They basically predated on small business, and put lots of drug money through the system, and also of course took taxpayers' money to keep them the show on the road. And of course that is what we should have been talking about for the last 10 years, instead of various distractions which have been waved in front of us.
It's interesting because part of the reason apparently for the financial crisis in 2008 was Lloyd's purchase of HBOS, and the fact that HBOS was not viable. It wasn't actually anywhere near as wealthy an organisation on the books as it was in the real world.
Well, they've still got loads of rubbish on the books, and that will become apparent when we hit the next set of buffers.
Mark, what do you make of this? Any thoughts about banking and the 2008 financial... Well, actually, some people call it a crash, don't they? Some people call it a crisis. I just say it was bailouts, because it was certainly there were some run-ons on the bank, but at the end of the day, we just gave them a load of money to carry on when maybe we should have let them crash. What are your thoughts on that?
I have lots and lots of thoughts about it, but the bottom line is we see... ongoing throughout history, the richer you are, the less you're judged, the more you can get away with. We bailed out the banks. The only place in the world it seems to have actually given anybody a hard time for that is in Iceland, and that was very recently, where they threw a whole bunch of bankers in jail, but it took a bunch of time to do it. You know, if I'm overdrawn, I'm kind of done in half an hour, but these guys are overdrawn, you know, I just help them get out of the red and back into the black. So there's nothing new. There's, you know, power and money work together to keep power and money in place. There's nothing deep or difficult about it.
Martin, what you're implying is that the banks have been overdrawn since 2008 and nothing's really changed.
Well, don't forget we've had quantitative easing and zero, and some countries negative interest rates. Now, that ain't in the textbook. That was supposed to be a stopgap measure for a few months. In 10 years later, we've got the biggest asset price bubble in history on the back of those, that kind of unconventional policy. And of course the far right, the von Mises Institute and the Austrian school economists are quite right. What happens if you do that is eventually it bursts, and what should have happened is the zombie bank should have been basically dismantled and lots of people should have been sent to prison, and that didn't happen, did it?
Before we hear from Anthony Stansfield, leave the last word with you, Nicola, because it does seem like it's a different world to most people.
Yeah,
the bankers are operating in. Is it another planet?
Yeah, I think it is a planet. And I mean, the thing that I think is really sad is that rather than the Conservative Party hold the bankers to account, they've used this as an opportunity to blame the Labour Party for bankrupting the country and introducing their austerity programme, where we've seen disabled people committing suicide because they've had their benefits cut.
Yeah, it's not just disabled people either, is it? I mean, it's an amazing number. Anyway, let's hear it from the Police and Crime Commissioner of the Thames Valley Police now.
I'm Anthony Stansfield, and I'm the Police and Crime Commissioner of Thames Valley. It's a very large force. We have the fourth largest population of any force in the country. The other big force is a metropolitan. We cover a vast area. It's Oxfordshire, Berkshire and Buckinghamshire.
Why have you taken this interest in the case here in Bristol with the Lloyd's Business Support Unit?
Because some of the victims are in my area, in Thames Valley, and there's one farming family that I think went down over 100 million on this. The sums of money involved are absolutely vast. We did a very similar one to what is alleged to have gone on in Lloyd's Bristol. It was the HBOS case in Reading, and we prosecuted on 245 million. The actual case was probably nearer £1 billion. I have no reason to think this one is any smaller.
So what is alleged to be going on here in Bristol?
Well, if I can describe it very simply, and there are 101 variations, but say a company is worth 100 million, doesn't matter who's worth 1 million, 10 million or 100 million, but if say it's worth 100 million and it owes the bank £10 million, it has a loan to expand, it can call that £10 million loan in almost overnight. And unless the company is able to pay it back immediately, they bankrupt the company. And what seems to have happened, and it certainly happened in the HBOS case, is the bank got its money back, and the assets of the company were sold off at a fraction of their real value to people who were cronies of the bank managers involved, and people made an enormous sum of money.
Well, what would you say to people who say, well, actually, since the, you know, if I make a loan to you, it's within my rights to call it back whenever I wish. It's actually my money.
Well, the only country, practically, any major country that doesn't have what's called a Chapter 11 system in place. And that means that if you call a loan in, and the loan isn't one that they've always paid their interest on it, they've never defaulted. Every other country has what's called Chapter 11, and the company gets at least 3 months to pay the loan back. What happens in this country is you can do it overnight, and it's an absolute open gate for fraudsters and con men.
But you would say, maybe some people would say anyway, but yes, it's legal.
Yes, calling in the loan possibly is legal. What is totally illegal is to sell off the assets for vastly less than they're worth and then go for the personal guarantees of the directors of the company and regain vastly more than the original loan. That is not legal.
Can you give us an example of maybe one or two of the things you came across with the HBOS case so we can get a picture of what may be going on in Bristol?
Companies were being taken to pieces and their assets sold for vastly less than they were really worth. And the fraudsters were making a huge amount of money out of this. And six people went down for an accumulative jail sentences of 48 years for this. I mean, it was a very, very serious fraud. One person got 15 years, and that is the heaviest you can possibly get for fraud.
Why do you think that there's so many victims, none of whom have yet got justice here in Bristol?
I think it's a combination of things. They are very, very similar. Some of the same individuals who were involved in HBOS seem to have been involved in Bristol. I don't believe that the police investigations have been anything like thorough enough. Most of the victims haven't even been approached. Or they've approached the police and they've just been told, go away. I think it's a totally unsatisfactory situation. I think this particular branch of this particular bank, which was Lloyds, seems to have been the centre of it for this particular bank all over the country. I mean, it's not just in the southwest. These victims are from Northern Ireland to Scotland, right across the country. And most of the cases seem to go back to Lloyds recoveries in Bristol.
Sue Mount-Stevens, who's our Police and Crime Commissioner, what would you advise her to do?
Well, I would have a very good look at who's been advising the police, for a start. One of the alleged involvements was from the very solicitors who are still solicitors to Avon and Somerset Police, and I find that extraordinary. I'm not going to go into Sue Mount-Stevens on a personal basis, but I certainly, as PCC, have taken a very keen interest in seeing these sort of cases are taken forward. I cannot force the police, but I take them personally very, very seriously, and I try to ensure that the police take them seriously.
Also, of course, there will be bankers who say, well, everybody's at it, Anthony. RBS have been doing this, HBOS have been doing it, all the banks do it, and if you're going to single out Lloyds in Bristol, that's simply not fair.
Well, it just happens to be where it's being done from. HBOS was being done largely from Reading. RBS was largely being done from Scotland, from branches there. So it's where it starts, and it's not a question of being fair or not. If they've been committing fraud, it should be investigated properly, wherever it is.
And what would you say to those that talk about the banksters in the 2008 crisis? It does seem it's not just too big to fail, it's also too big to jail.
I wouldn't use the word banksters. I would use the word fraudsters. Most of them aren't even qualified bankers. I think Lloyds has on its board of about, I think it's about 16 or 17 people. It only has one qualified banker, which I find extraordinary. And I think that's one of the things that's gone wrong. And it's not all the banks that have done this. I mean, certain banks' names come up the whole time. And it was HBOS, Lloyds, RBS and Clydesdale seem to be the main offenders in this, but I think there have been bank managers in other banks who have done it, but not on the industrial scale that it was done on in these banks, I believe.
Do you think that there is an element in these risk committees of these banks that think, well, if we can carry on getting away with this, we're making a tremendous amount of money at it, so why stop?
Yes, I think that's been the problem. Unless you bring these things to justice, in America they're much better at it, and they do put bankers in jail. We have not put a single serious senior person on a bank board in jail, and it should have been done. And if you want to have a look at the criminality of this, you need to read what is called the Masterton Report, or the Turnbull Report, which has been now published. I read it 2 or 3 years ago. It names the names, and it names the companies, and it is an absolute layout of criminality in a very large bank.
Well, you're painting a picture almost of a lawless nation when it comes to bankers.
I think we have a real problem, not just with bankers, but with some of our major legal practices. And I think a number of other professions have been involved in this, which I think is really depressing. I was managing director of a company. We worked all over the world. And I always found that other countries were fairly corrupt. And I never really expected to find how corrupt we have become at a senior level in our professions in this country, and I find it absolutely disgraceful. But it's very interesting, in Australia, something very, very similar to this happened, and it caused, really, the two prime ministers to lose their jobs, and they had a proper royal commission into this, which produced its interim report earlier this year, which was absolutely devastating about this. And funnily enough, the two Australian senators who brought that royal commission forward were in the UK last week, and I had a meeting with them, and they said ours has absolute similarities to what they had. In America, in the cases of the many, many forged signatures that are used to take people to prove bankruptcy courts, the banks were fined, the biggest fine ever in America, I believe, it was $25 billion for doing this. And in this country, we have done absolutely precisely nothing, really, to bring it to justice, yes, except for the Thames Valley HBOS case.
Now, you mentioned a report just then. Do you think there is any other sources of information that might arm those, either survivors or victims of Lloyd's Business Support Unit, or those trying to get justice for them, their supporters?
Yes, I think there are. I think the Turnbull Report is the absolute key one. It's been sitting with the SFA and the Financial Conduct Authority for far too long, and nothing has been done about it yet. There are other reports. I can't go into their names. I can't remember off the top of their head. But there is ample evidence for this, and there is ample evidence that those who should be investigating it are not investigating.
I mean, we've got lots of agencies that are supposed to be doing this kind of thing. You mentioned the Serious Fraud Office, the National Crime Agency, Action Fraud, people like this.
I think one easy way is to put these things off is always to say somebody else is investigating it. And we have, as you say, a number of agencies, and they shuffle these prosecutions amongst themselves. And even when you have a case that looks absolutely clear, it'll go to the Crown Prosecution Service, and they find it all too difficult, and nothing is done about it.
I've just read this new book about the death of David Kelly, Dr. David Kelly, which, of course, was in the Thames Valley area.
It happened before my time. I don't know the details, and I think most of the police officers involved have retired now. But certainly when you look at it, it seems at best odd, doesn't it?
Bit cheeky of me to ask Anthony Stansfield about the death of David Kelly right at the very end there. But Martin, there's a whole series of, I think, fascinating things he's coming up with there, not least of which the same solicitors apparently are advising Lloyd's as are advising Avon and Somerset Police.
Yeah, well, we had Andy Marsh, the chief constable, in here some months ago, didn't we? And we did discuss fraud in a general way. And, of course, we mentioned the Blue Arrow case from many years ago in the City of London, because we had Rowan Bosworth Davis on the show, who was a chief fraud officer for Metropolitan
Police.
Well, that's
right. That was a few years ago. But what he said was that he submitted to the Finance Select Committee his little report, and he was an ex-fraud squad detective, and he said, well, actually, the City of London is analogous to organised criminal activity. And what he was actually saying was it fulfils all the criteria of various different international definitions of organised crime. So if you have basking in the sun one day in the next few weeks in Castle Park, maybe if you've got a camera, take a few photographs of people going in and out of the business support unit, over exercise your right of to take photos of people, you may see some of them in the news. And in fact, when I spoke to another journalist in the city earlier this week, he was saying, are they actually
in there to close the place down. Is this the police? But Nicola, I mean, having heard that, I mean, it's we don't know the rights or wrongs of this case. Maybe something will happen in the future, maybe not. But it does sound as if we've got a complete. I mean, some people are above the law, effectively.
I mean, I thought it was a bit harsh, really, to say that Avon and Somerset police perhaps aren't as thorough as they should be, because, you know, we've lost over 600 police personnel since the Tories came into power. So that's something to think about. And also, I've been watching the Endeavour Morse series on TV, and I don't think that Thames Valley police are as thorough as corruptible as we might have been led to believe from that article. So. Yes, interesting.
So you also having another thing, Martin, was having only one, and I thought fascinating, Lloyds Bank board with only one qualified banker on the board. Now, this is the sort of thing I was suggesting to the police, wasn't it, as well, saying that actually what we should be doing is getting business people in, get Richard Branson in or somebody like this to take over these organisations. That's clearly happening in banking. People with no experience of banking are now running the show. They're sitting in these jobs with massive payouts, but they actually have no qualifications in the industry.
Well, Paul Galbraith, who's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous US economist, he's based at the University of Austin in Texas. He's an expert on all of this. And in actual fact, what should happen after you have a crash like the savings and loans scandals in the 1980s in the US, 1,000 people were sent down for fraud. And if you don't send people down for fraud, you've basically given a green light to fraudsters to steal. And fining the banks doesn't do any good, but banks have been fined for fixing the LIBOR rate and so on the rest of it. Fining the institution is no deterrent, because it's basically just raking some cream off the top of what they're stealing. And it's just the cost of doing business. And if you don't send people to prison, you then create systematic fraud. And we've got a situation in the City of London where if they were to start arresting people, they'd have to arrest everybody, and therefore they can't arrest everybody, so they arrest nobody. And the Blue Arrow case, as Rowan Bosworth David pointed out, they went after what they call the blue bloods of the city, because they didn't want to go for small fry, because they've got limited resources. But of course, that case was dismissed by a judge who went to school with the defendants.
Well, actually, it was they got a suspended sentence, and then they went to appeal and got the suspended sentence overturned. And Rowan said, the word came down from on high at Scotland Yard Fraud Squad that no more arrests of bankers in 1993.
Well, then he resigned from the Metropolitan Police. He's now a professor of criminology, and as you pointed out, his PhD thesis was about why banks are criminal organisations.
Okay, well, let's get back to Brexit. Oh, gosh. Well, apparently, 29th of March is out now. We're not going to be leaving on the 29th of March. It's either going to be the 22nd of May or the 12th of April. The 22nd of May, if that MPs approve Theresa May's deal, and the 12th of April if they don't. So they get an extra couple of weeks. Nicola, what do you make? Can you explain Brexit to us? What do you think is going to happen, and what are the rights and wrongs of it?
Well, we don't know what's going to happen, do we? And we can't decide on the rights or wrongs, because the country is divided between whether we stay or whether we go. I think what most people are annoyed about is the decision-making process, and the fact that Theresa May has had absolutely no authority to come to any sort of, I don't know, decision or outcome for any of us. And I think yesterday, you know, she spent 2 days doing these grand speeches, once in front of the UK and the other in front of people at the European Union, with this master plan. And Europe have just stuck their fingers up to her and said, actually, you're not calling the shots. So who knows where we're going with this?
Well, before we hear from Martin and Mark, let's have a listen to the speech you mentioned there, which is Theresa May. Well, I'm not sure if it was the one you meant, but anyway, this is a little clip from the speech that Theresa May made this week, really pointing the finger at Parliament and saying, yeah, look, you don't want Brexit, we got to have Brexit, otherwise we're not doing what the people told us to do.
So far, Parliament has done everything possible to avoid making a choice. Motion after motion and amendment after amendment has been tabled without Parliament ever deciding what it wants. All MPs have been willing to say is what they do not want. I passionately hope MPs will find a way to back the deal I've negotiated with the EU. A deal that delivers on the result of the referendum and is the very best deal negotiable. and I will continue to work night and day to secure the support of my colleagues, the DUP, and others for this deal. But I am not prepared to delay Brexit any further than the 30th of June. Some argue that I'm making the wrong choice, and I should ask for a longer extension to the end of the year or beyond, to give more time for politicians to argue over the way forward. That would mean asking you to vote in European elections nearly 3 years after our country decided to leave. What kind of message would that send? And just how bitter and divisive would that election campaign be at a time when the country desperately needs bringing back together? Some have suggested holding a second referendum. I don't believe that's what you want, and it is not what I want. We asked you the question already, and you gave us your answer. Now you want us to get on with it, and that is what I am determined to do.
Well, I mean, this speech has gone down like a lead balloon, both in Brussels and in Parliament. And, you know, she's not much, not long for this world. I mean, the removal van is on its way to number 10 as we speak.
But hang on, she's not going to be going, is she? Because she managed to stay at the end of last year, survive a vote, and they can't kick her out for another year
no,
after
well,
that. She'll probably almost certainly be there until November.
Well, what's going to happen now is imponderable. Nobody ever intended to end up in this kind of impasse. And I mean, I could lay out the possible ways in which this is going to play out.
Go on, please do.
Well, I mean, she's not going to get her vote through next week. That's pretty clear.
Okay, so that means we're going to be leaving on the 12th of April.
No. That's the date that's been given by the EU for us to make our minds up about what we want to do. And then, of course, Parliament may decide. I mean, what Corbyn is trying to do is saying, well, we could cobble together a majority for a soft Brexit, and the Labour Party might agree to go with that. I mean, that's clearly his preferred posture rather than a referendum. But of course she'll have to ditch the DUP and the Jacob Rees-Moggites, but she's not going to do that. And of course a general election would already have been forced apart from the Fixed Term Parliament Act. So we're getting a real lesson in the constitutional niceties of our setup. When Berkoff, you know, ruled out the third vote on the basis that the 1604 Erskine May, I mean, the rest of Europe finds it extraordinary that the precedents from the 17th century are being used. But I mean, that's the British setup, isn't it?
John Bercow's actually only saying what a lot of people are thinking is, what's the point in keep bringing the same vote and getting nowhere? It's almost as if she's just trying to use up time. Now, you mentioned the DUP there. I wonder what role you think Stormont would have played if they'd been sitting, because it was January 2017 Martin McGuinness resigned as Deputy First Minister over in Northern Ireland. Ever since there, we've had no Northern Ireland Parliament. Now, this has meant that the DUP are the only people we hear from, and they seem to be the only people who have any say. What would have been being said, do you think, in Stormont over the last
The obvious constitutional issues here is that the six counties in fact voted to remain in the EU.
What I'm saying is, it's rather handy, isn't it, that nobody is discussing this in Stormont, as Northern Ireland has been key to this whole
Because Theresa May called the election and she ended up being dependent on the DUP for support. We've now got the DUP basically in a pole position in the situation. And of course, the other Europeans are all learning how awkward they can be. And I don't think
they were very awkward during the Northern Ireland peace process.
They've always been awkward.
And they did everything they could, the DUP, to stop the Good Friday Agreement.
Well, they did, but then, to be fair to them, they also went along with it in the end. So when Martin McGuinness died, Arlene Foster turned up to the funeral and got a standing ovation from all the Republicans in Armagh Cathedral. So I think people who think that it's going to turn back to war are probably, you know, missing the point here. Politically, it's going to be very... If there is a no-deal Brexit, for example, on 12th of April, Sinn Féin have made their position clear that we're going to call for a United Ireland ballot, that would be
cynical,
very divisive.
But isn't one of the reasons they don't want a border in Northern Ireland because it's been, for years, people have made quite a lot of money smuggling across that border?
Well, look, the border has disappeared, and the smuggling is what could happen if Theresa May had retained her majority is that you could have had a hard no-deal Brexit in England, but Northern Ireland would have remained inside the customs union. That would all, and the DUP wouldn't have liked that, but they wouldn't have had any power, and they could have been just told to put up with it.
Well, to be fair, Boris Johnson and David Davis did resign as soon as they said this backstop thing has got to be there. They just said, "Well, that's well, silly. The backstop, we're not staying. We're not."
Well, right. If we get a No Deal Brexit on the 12th of April, which is certainly one of the possibilities, just by default, it's not what people
you know
want.
Whose fault it will be? It will be Gina Miller's fault, who insisted that Parliament had to have a meaningful vote in order for this whole thing
to go
through.
She just took it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said the legal position is this. You can't just bypass Parliament.
Well, what was
she was intending to do it without any parliamentary procedure at all.
What was going to happen was that the government was going to do all this negotiation themselves. And the only reason Parliament's playing any role is could a good old Gina Miller in her case in November 2016.
Well,
let's not forget that. A lot of people seem
But the point about that is she took it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court gave the legal position, which is that Parliament can't be sidelined. Don't forget we had a civil war about this in the 17th century, Tony.
Gina Miller didn't have to do that. Anyway, I wonder if we're going to be going back to pounds, shillings and pence. What do you think, Mark, after Brexit, if it happens?
I remember when pounds, shillings and pence became... 100p in a pound and all of that. I was a
decimalization. Me too.
I was a
yeah.
kid in boarding school and went to the tuck shop and nobody knew what was going on. I want to just make one point, which is extraordinary. In her speech, she says I all the time. I meaning nay, not yes. In this case, this is I think it's really her. I was going to say a government, but I don't even think it's a government. You have a split in the country on the vote, which is really basically 50-50. If it had been maybe better weather the next day or whatever, it may have come out the other way. So
That's like Labour Tory, though, isn't it?
That's the country. So the country is clearly split. So the job of leadership then is to try and find a bridge so the country can find a path to move forward together. Instead of that, we have a situation where parties are still hanging on to their individual party political positions, and nobody has ever reached out across the parties, except for now when we're 2 minutes before, the whatever hitting the fan. So I think that what is ignored all the time here, and we keep getting involved in politics, is that we human beings are emotional creatures. We don't think logically. And that emotional thing has been turned off in Theresa May, and she is not able to reach out and say, if I really want to lead this country forward, we have to find a way to work together. And this has been totally ignored. It's still being ignored. And sadly, it's entrenched the situation even more to a place where people now are really at each other's throats. And the way forward... That's one other thing I wanted to say. It seems to me extraordinary that, we can't have enough of a referendum because that was the will of the people, but you can have as many re-votes on the same deal as you want. So why is it good in one case but not good in the other case? That, to me, is really peculiar. So, why is it like, you could get your cake and get to keep it as well. Eat your cake and then eat it, and whatever the expression is.
Now, Nicola, Theresa May, some people will be listening to that and saying, well, at least she's doggedly going to do what the people voted for back in 2016. And although people may not agree with it, there's some people actually admire her for that.
Some people might admire her for that, but you have to remember that people were misled by the Conservative and the Leave campaign.
Well, not by both campaigns.
Yeah, I think so, and I think although we're getting annoyed by all these debates in politics, I think it's given people a really good opportunity to understand what the real debate around Brexit is. So. Yeah.
Also, I think one of the wonders of radio is we can bring back dead people. And one of them is Tony Benn. He's a former MP in Bristol. And I've heard very, very little of Tony Benn because he was had very passionate views on the European Union throughout his parliamentary career. He saw through that whole time during the Labour Party, when the Labour Party went from a Eurosceptic to a Europhile party under Neil Kinnock. And so I thought we'd have a listen now to a Thames TV clip. This is from 1975, 2 years after we entered the Common Market. And then there was a vote as exactly like the one we've just had as to whether or not to leave. And that vote was given to us by Labour in 1975, which hadn't been the opportunity given to us by the Conservatives in 1973. So it's almost like turned on its head with the parties now anyway. So let's have a listen now to Roy Jenkins debating with Tony Benn back in 1975. Martin, if you can just tell us who Roy Jenkins was.
Well, he was a sort of very cerebral Tory Labour minister who was found a member of the SDP and very pro-European in the way that Tony Benn was.
He eventually left the Labour Party over the Europe issue, didn't he? So let's have a listen to a clip from this debate, which was a BBC panorama back in 1975 with Roy Jenkins and Tony Benn.
So what I do query, I query to that extent your basic figures. But of course I don't suggest for a moment that you take figures out of the... just make up figures from the...
They start talking about trade, surprise, surprise. Trade
statistics. Of course you take those figures accurately. But I do query, and query absolutely fundamentally...
That's Roy Jenkins.
...draw from them. I think the deductions bear no relationship to reality at all. It's as though you were to say, which indeed would be the truth, that it was as cold on the Saturday before Whitsun Bank holiday, as I think it was, a little colder maybe than on Christmas Day. Now, if you announce this, I would say certainly I agree with your figures. But if you then, which I think is more or less the equivalent to what you've done, is to say that proves decisively that because it was colder on spring bank holiday than it was on Christmas Day, we must have moved into the southern hemisphere, and that we are going to swing round winters and summers, and we'd better make our dispositions on this basis in the future, then I would think that led to a very false and indeed dangerous conclusion. And I would regard your 500,000 job figure, and still more, your junior minister's addition to it of 250,000 as being in that sort of category of reasoning.
Well, can I just say one word on this, because I'm
very
glad...
We're about halfway through our time.
Well, I understand that.
I know you both have many points you want to make.
But you see, a joke about weather is not really right when we're talking about people's jobs, their security, their future, and so on. We are talking about jobs.
I'm not joking about jobs,
but I
know that perfectly.
I know,
but if you challenge me as to what extent I dispute your figures or your methodology, then I indicate that to some extent I dispute the figures, as I've indicated, and that I dispute almost wholly the methodology, and therefore the conclusion which follows from it, as indeed has done the Chancellor of the Exchequer, as indeed has done the Independent National Institute of Economic and Social Research, which is not very pro-market, and which has produced conclusions in the last week directly contrary to yours.
No, I think the figures, and this is important to establish, and you've been quite fair about it, and I'm not grumbling, the figures came from official government statistics. Now, all political argument is about interpretation. And in an election, conservatives will say to you, our problems are due to the Labour government. They're saying it now. And you will say, no, it's due to something else. And we all do this. This is what political argument is about. But you see, we are now looking at a situation where there is a last chance vote for the British people on Thursday. And there is a lot of evidence, and if you want me to give a clear example, Scotland was in the common market with the United Kingdom over many years, and 35,000 Scots had to come south every year in search of work because of deindustrialization. There is enough evidence, and it's available to our eyes to see, that the centre of British industry, or the centre of industry in the community, will move to the Ruhr, that we will lose manufacturing jobs at an accelerating rate, that our real growth market is with the rest of the world, and that this will not only affect factory workers, car workers, engineering workers, steel workers, Imperial typewriters moving to Germany, singers in Glasgow moving to Germany, not only affect them, but white-collar workers, and then the pressure for cuts in public expenditure, now very strongly urged by Conservative spokesmen, means that public servants, local government officials, and others will be affected. And my argument, which I don't think has been shaken at all by our exchange, is that we face a genuine danger, of which we've already some early evidence, that our failure to compete within the common market with German and French industry, particularly as captives of French food, which we'll come to in a minute, will lead to the deindustrialization of Britain, to loss of jobs, and this will extend throughout the economy.
So that's former Bristol MP Tony Benn, who was in the Labour cabinet and the shadow cabinet. Martin, what do you make of that? Because it's interesting, some of the same sort of things come up, don't they? Saying, actually, most of our trade is with the rest of the world. We keep hearing that today, don't we?
Well, it's not true. In actual fact, most of our trade is with the European Union, although we do have trade with the rest of the world. In economics, it's called gravity equations. In actual fact, one of our major trading partners, believe it or not, is the Republic of Ireland, which is pretty obvious if you think about it, because they're our next door neighbours.
But is it interesting to think the way the same issues come up again and again? I suppose maybe it would be nice. I'll try and get another clip with Tony Benn for next week, especially just because he was a fantastic Bristol MP I met and had a lot of time and respect for. But we have to give both sides. What do you make of Tony Benn's arguments there. He's saying, and what he's saying effectively does seem to have happened, that largely the country is, the industries right across Britain, since he was talking there in 1975, many of them have gone either abroad. Steel industry, he's talking about the car industry. We don't make cars here anymore.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm half Israeli and half English, half British. In Israel, there was a time when they wanted to have an industry and they started making cars. Well, they don't have any natural resources in Israel, so they had to import the steel to make the cars. I mean, how insane is that? So here, the natural resources we have, I don't know a lot about it, and I'm sure Martin is much wiser about this than me, but a lot of our natural resources, specifically coal and stuff like that, are basically going to be unusable soon due to climate change and issues we have, unless we find another way to manipulate that fuel without it causing some kind of terrible, you know, awful stuff to the planet. And basically, as far as I understand, in my limited understanding of this stuff, stuff like steelwork and all of this heavy-duty industry has moved away from Europe in general and is basically in Asia and, you know, trying to be pulled back to America. So this was going to happen anyway. On top of everything else, as far as I can see, today, more people have come here to work than have left in the end. He talks about singers and people working and leaving. Well, everybody wants to come here to work because it's such a good place to work. So I think that kind of was upside down. But I am no expert. I do know that I do appreciate the fact that it's been a rough ride for a lot of people. But I think that's to do with the way we've run our country and nothing to do with how we've engaged with Europe.
What do you make of Tony Benn's claims there, Nicola, about deindustrialisation in Britain? Do you think it would have happened anyway without being in the EEC or the EU?
I mean, that's really difficult to say now, but, you know, one of the things about Tony Benn is that he was a pacifist, and, you know, tomorrow there is a march in London around Brexit, and there's a 97-year-old brigadier marching because of the fact that since we've been in the European Union, we've had peace in Europe, and that's something we're not talking about, and I think that's something that Tony Benn certainly would have spoken about, and that's something we need to think about. Not just the finance behind Europe, but the other things.
Can I just throw in a thought on top of that? I so agree with you, Nicola. That, you know, the European Union or the common market was originally created to create a financial embrace between France and Germany that would make it impossible for them to go back and slaughter each other again, and the rest of us joining in with that. The amount of people killed in the Second World War is equivalent to waking up tomorrow morning and everybody in this country is dead. Everybody. 70-odd million people were killed in the Second World War. You know, the First World War, 35 million, that was the war to end world wars. And then we said, actually, we can do better than that in the same century. Let's double that number and, you know, really put it out there. So, to me, the fact that we've had all these years of peace and prosperity is more important than anything else. This is something which we are endangering enormously by leaving Europe. We're moving into a time in the world with climate change where we need to work together more than ever before, with extremism beginning to like flex its muscles in a way we've never seen. By dividing and conquering, which is what we're doing, we're opening up the floodgates for disaster after disaster, you know, that humankind is so good at, you know, putting out there when they...
What about this argument that it's better to be ruled by people who are reasonably close to you rather than people who are distant, to have superpowers?
Well, I think that's very interesting. I mean, as a woman, we managed to, you know, you're talking about the impact on industry, but as women, we gained the right to have pensions on an equal footing to men as a result of the European Union. The Conservative Party just want to make money out of us, but actually Europe has come to our aid and, you know, improved the quality of our working lives. So that's not something we should overlook.
Okay, can we just draw our line under Brexit here for a bit? Because we had a big full council meeting. Were you there this week?
Yes, that
one
was.
Very good, because apparently one or two Labour people weren't, and therefore there was a vote which went against the Labour Party in the city, which was to do with the remuneration or supposed for the former chief exec's payout, where the Lord Mayor voted, had a casting vote and voted to have some sort of inquiry into why this £100,000 was paid to Anna Klonowski, which didn't apparently need to be paid. But I think there was a certain amount of shambolic things, if I can call it that. Maybe it would be interesting to have a listen to, or maybe I'll put a link up to on the show page to the webcast of that meeting, because there were things that apparently should have been debated that weren't debated, like, for example, what's been going on up at Stoke Lodge. And there's a story in the Bristol Post this week saying Stoke Lodge campaigners demand to see the council's legal advice that gagged them. Well, they got a petition going. They were supposed to have a debate on Tuesday, and they were told no, there won't be any debate on Stoke Lodge because there's some kind of court thing going on. It's not going to be discussed at all. But anyway, what was your impressions from Tuesday?
You know, I think that the question about the payoff is, we need some transparency around that. People are asking for answers and we need to give them. I mean, I remember when at the council meeting when we were all asked to vote to approve Nicola's employment, and I voted against it, actually. So right from the very beginning, there was controversy.
Why?
Because there were concerns raised about the process. And, you know, that's what happened then. And now we're debating how she left. So, you know, I think we need to learn. Helen Holland gave a really good speech at the council meeting saying, look, you know, if we've done things wrong, we need to learn from the past. But we can only learn from the past if we understand what's happened. So we do need to know exactly what happened. And if that payment was made and it shouldn't have been paid, then, you know, people need to be held to account for that decision, because it's no one's money except taxpayers' money.
It's always easy to pay, I suppose, somebody if it's not your own money that you're paying,
exactly.
But it's ours. But what about Stoke Lodge? The campaigners are demanding to see the council's legal advice that gagged them. A dispute has been going on for 8 years with Cottam School just over the last couple of months. Fences have gone up. The local people say it's the only place they can go, the only bit of public space. It's owned by the city council, but there's going to be no discussion about it. Nevertheless, and that people were, I think, protesting at a council meeting saying, Why are you not prepared to talk about this?
Well, I think people should be allowed to see the legal advice that was given to the council. You know, how are we going to move this situation forward? Both sides have very emotive arguments, and we need to make a decision based on the facts. And we can't make decisions if the facts are withheld from us. So I think that information should be made available to people. That's my view. And some of the things didn't get debated in the council meeting because we ran out of time.
So it's going to be a while till there's another full council, isn't it? So this stuff is being sort of, it sounds to me as if, you know, things are being kicked into the long grass a little bit. Oh, we didn't really want to talk about that.
Yeah, well, that goes on a lot in politics, doesn't it?
But well, it goes on in big business, certainly, is that, but not so much in politics. Things are supposed to be open and accountable in politics. That's why we vote for you guys and girls.
Yeah, well, we have a system in Bristol, which is we have an elected mayor, and an elected mayor has a lot of power. And, you know, that's something maybe we need to debate at a later date, whether as a city we want an elected mayor, but we're not here to debate that today. But there should be greater transparency. You know, we ask people to vote for us, we come out on a platform, and we should be accountable, and that includes being transparent, giving people information so that they can make decisions themselves.
And if the information isn't forthcoming, out
well,
you go.
It should be. Yeah, I think so.
People won't vote for
you. You know, the Tories said a lot of things about the mayor, and if they're not happy, then there are avenues that they can go down to hold him accountable for the decision-making that has gone on. But I can't do that.
I mean, it's a similarity a little bit with the Lloyds thing we were talking about earlier with Marvin Rees, because he came in having not been a councillor before.
Yeah, that's strange, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, so obviously he's not doing £1 billion fraud, as far as I know. And neither are Lloyds, of course. That's all alleged. But interesting that when people kind of come in and are parachuted in at the top to these nice jobs, even though, of course, we voted for Marvin. Anyway, let's have a listen now to some real stuff from the real world. And this is from Prime Minister's Questions, looking at education cuts and poverty.
Dr. Roberta Blackman-Woods.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
On Friday, I visited a school in my constituency where distressing poverty means that teachers are not only providing food for the children at breakfast and lunch, they are sourcing clothes and buying shoes for them, in addition to raising money for books and equipment. Now that school, the only one in the area, is threatened with closure. So rather than spending money trying to get people to back her Brexit deal, could I ask the Prime Minister, please, to use it to address the acute social need in this country that is bringing families and communities to their knees?
Yeah.
Well, the Honourable Lady will be well aware that we are putting more money into our schools. We are ensuring that we have a welfare system that does encourage people into the workplace, and we have put more money into various other elements of the of care for people across our communities. The best solution for people to ensure that they are able to provide for themselves and their families is for us to have a strong economy and for people to be helped into work. And that's why it was so pleasing to see this week that we see, yet again, employment levels at a record high in this country.
So, Nicola, there we are. Employment's a record high. Therefore, there's all these marvellous opportunities, and kids don't need to go without books and without food and without shoes.
That's true.
So
but they do. We know they
so
do.
So why is it? There's something, some sort of mismatch between what the Prime Minister's saying there and the reality on the ground, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, it might appear that we've got more people in employment, but we've got things like zero-hour contracts and other things that mask employment rates and the amount of money that people are being paid. But we've got children at schools who haven't even got toothbrushes and they haven't got shoes. How on earth are they supposed to get through a day of education when their basic needs aren't being met? And, you know, we know that schools aren't getting any more money, and in South Gloucestershire they're within the worst funded in the whole of the country, so it's falling on deaf ears.
Yeah, I mean, it's just politicking, isn't it? I mean, what's fascinating to me, coming back to the B word, is that all this billions of pounds have been put aside to deal with a no deal Brexit, and you feel like saying, well, what else in the budget are you going to cut?
Well, what about,
of course, there's austerity,
Martin? What about employment
deniers?
I think we're talking about employment figures here.
Okay,
because there seems to be she's saying there's more and more people employed. Is it simply, do you think, that there's less and less unemployed? There are reasons for that. For example, that people just are living, for example, taking money from gangs, crime, doing organised crime, because they're getting sanctioned and they're finding it difficult to claim what they're entitled to under Social Security.
Well, having more people in employment is quite straightforward. You have an increase in population, so that's a basic point to make. There are more people employed than in 1975, but the population's increased by a considerable amount since then, so that doesn't mean much. And of course, what's really happening is many people in work are actually worse off than they would have been on benefits in the 1970s, and that's to do with things like rents and so on.
She's implying that work is a route out of poverty,
well,
but there's questions about that, aren't
there? It isn't. And don't forget that all of this is based, as I said earlier, on quantitative easing and zero interest rates, which are not in the textbook. And of course, once you get rid of those, then there's going to be an almighty crash and all these people are going to be out on their ear.
Briefly, Mark, what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, you also have to remember that people are staying in work much longer than ever before. So, because they can't afford to retire. Yeah, so absolutely, you know, so the pension age is changing and it's going to go up and go down. And people are, you know, you're getting much less on benefits. So as you said, people are out working, but they're working for a pittance that doesn't pay the rent and they can't feed themselves on it.
Okay, time for the US-owned Comcast News at 7. Thanks to our guest Labour councillor for Frim Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones, Labour Party Oxford economist Martin Summers, and also Mark's man will be here after the news.
2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.